Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Tribletow from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today are two guests from the communications firm Labrador. From New Hampshire, we have Laura Ann Smith, who is Advisory Director, and from North Carolina, Judy Mayo, who's also an Advisory Director. And today we're going to be talking about environmental disclosures. Laura Ann, Judy, thank you both for joining us. Judy, why don't we start with you? Can you talk to us about the impact of Scope 1 and 2 disclosures being scaled back and the dropping of Scope 3 emission disclosures in the U.S.? I think people are not used to having things dropped. They're used to having things added these days.
Right. This of course, refers to the SEC's new climate rule, which was issued about a week and a half ago. And when it was proposed a while ago, it got thousands and thousands of comments from companies who had a lot of issues with the scope of what was going to be required from them going forward on emission disclosures. So after a lot of deliberation, the SEC decided to remove the requirement from about 4,000 registrants, about half the registrants in this country, to have to disclose scope one and two emissions. That is only now applicable to large accelerated filers and accelerated filers with some qualifications to that. But it did carve out a huge swath of registrants in the U.S. Additionally, the dropping of the requirement to disclose scope three emissions was met with a huge sigh of relief, because that is generally the largest scope of emissions that any company has. It's your upstream and your downstream emissions. You may not even have that information available. It might be very difficult to aggregate and obtain. So in recognition of that, the SEC just dropped the requirement to disclose your scope three emissions. So it is a big deal for companies, a big win for companies for this. That does not take the pressure off of the large accelerated filers and the accelerated filers, who now will need to disclose their material scope one and two emissions. It may turn out they don't have material emissions, but they still need to go through the process to determine that. So that's going to be a lot of work for the large accelerated filers and the accelerated filers to comply with this.
It certainly sounds like it. It's a lot to track, and especially as you point out, the stuff of outside your factory, if you will, the upstream, the downstream part. Now, Laura Ann, which companies will be affected by the ruling?
Sure. So most operating companies that file with the SEC, including IPO issuers and foreign issuers, are on some level impacted in the future over the extended timeline for implementation to have to make certain of the disclosures related to governance matters, and as well as the additional financial statement disclosures. As Judy indicated, those bearing the largest burden, though, are the large accelerated filers and the accelerated filers, who are going to have to first begin all of their disclosures sooner, and two, are also going to have to include those scope one and scope two emissions. I think one of the things, though, that is important to think about here is not just what is this rule requiring, but also understanding that with the new climate rule, we may see a baseline level of expectation that is now set for all companies, certainly all public companies. So while there are those that will have to comply sooner and later with the SEC climate rules, I think we will see some shifting of landscape here that may create other expectations around disclosure on a go-forward basis.
Now, on a go-forward basis, we can't talk about emissions reporting without talking about Europe. What's the impact of all this going to be on U.S. headquartered companies with business in the EU, given the EU's own new ESG mandates?
Sure. So I'll field that one as well and just carry on to say that for those companies that are listed in the EU or for those with significant EU operations, they are already abundantly aware that they are subject at some time in the near term to CSRD. And so they should already be instituting processes to collect and analyze the data that's going to be required to disclose there. It tends to be broader than the SEC's climate rules, but it's not completely overlapping. The good news is, if you are subject to CSRD, if you're one of those companies, the processes that you have to go through there are going to assist you in complying with the SEC climate rules. The other thing that I would say is for those companies that are potentially subject to CSRD, they need to look at the timing, because depending on the size of their company or the extent of their business in the EU or those other factors that impact implementation timing, compliance with the SEC rules may actually come for some or all of them prior to compliance with the CSRD.
So, Judy, how does the SEC's rule impact ESG reporting moving forward?
Yeah, it's, you know, we're a disclosure firm. Labrador is a disclosure firm. So we look at disclosure broadly. And this is a really great opportunity for companies to take a look at where they talk about ESG in any publication. It could be in their sustainability report. It could be in their proxy statement. It could be in their website. The climate and climate risk impact a lot of different communication venues for companies. So companies are going to really need to look at what's the purpose of each of their various publications. Who's their audience? There are discrete stakeholders, the stakeholders to whom the SEC rule is addressed, investors, are different than perhaps the audience for an ESG report, which could include the community and legislators and customers. The audience for your proxy statement, again, is a little different. The audience for your website and your marketing material that might say something about the climate benefits of your product, that needs to be reviewed also to see what the purpose is. And all of these disclosures need to be harmonized. They need to be looked at together to make sure that what you're saying in one place, especially in an SEC report, is consistent with what you're seeing elsewhere. There are different levels of liability, obviously, that attach to SEC file documents that don't attach to, let's say, what's on your website necessarily. But as a matter of good communication hygiene, all of these need to be looked at together. The other thing to think about is the processes that companies are going to need to go through to come up with their disclosures under the SEC rule. There are internal controls, disclosure controls and procedures. All of those procedures should be looked at as a single method of providing information for all of the various reporting avenues. The teams need to get together. The processes should be you know, perhaps combined so that there's a single source of truth within the company for climate and climate related information.
Having that one single point of truth is important, because a lot of times when you get into this stuff, we get into materiality issues. What will be defined as material now, and how will it impact their reporting? Lorianne, do you have any thoughts on this?
Sure. So issuers were certainly happy to see the inclusion of materiality thresholds sprinkled throughout the final rules. And I think the process for determining materiality under the climate rules will impact how companies assess ESG report disclosures as well. The SEC made it clear that traditional notions of materiality apply to the climate rules, but the hard work is actually determining whether or not particular pieces of information, including scope 1 and scope 2 emissions, are in fact material for the company. And that is going to require working closely with teams across the company to not only make those determinations, but also to properly document those decisions. So this, I think, is one of the key compliance aspects that will impact multiple teams who ideally are already working together around ESG reporting, but may require them to do so more closely and in a different way than they have been doing historically. It's also important to know that internal and external auditors are going to be all over this. They're going to be looking for updates to companies' internal controls, as well as their disclosure control procedures. And oh, by the way, your CEO and CFO are going to care a lot about those controls, the compliance with those controls, and ultimately the determination of materiality and the disclosures that flow from that determination, because that will all be covered by their certifications to the 10K. So something they will be keenly aware of, because that has potential criminal liability for them. The other thing that I think that we can be assured of is for those companies that opt not to make disclosures under the rules on the basis of materiality should expect a comment letter from the SEC following that first 10K where the disclosures are required, asking them to support their assessment and how they reach that materiality conclusion. I also think that we should expect investors to ask companies about their materiality determinations during ongoing engagements, because keep in mind that investors will still view your emissions as significant to them, even if not material to the company. And so I also think it's important to keep in mind that while the SEC rules apply that traditional securities law concept of materiality, as we talked about earlier, there are other rules at play here in other jurisdictions that have different materiality requirements. And so think of CSRD and its double materiality, which focuses on external impacts, not just financial impacts to the company. Also keep in mind that under CSRD, your assurance is going to have to speak to that materiality determination, whereas under the SEC rules, if you don't end up needing to include scope one or scope two emissions based on materiality, you may never reach the assurance requirement because you don't have those emissions to assure in your report. So I think to bring it home on materiality, this is going to give some latitude for companies to make determinations that previous disclosures were voluntary and do not in fact meet a materiality threshold. So we may see some companies who were voluntarily reporting pull back on the inclusion of their scope one and scope two emissions. But on the flip side of that, I think we're also going to see many others who may opt to lean in and continue voluntary disclosure of information, including potentially scope three information, because they are going to view the inclusion of that information and the providing of additional information for their investors as a potential competitive advantage.
Well, it's one of those areas that continues to evolve. And, you know, as we touched upon a little bit, it's not just what US law says. There's a lot going on in Europe in this area, and with implications ranging from criminal law to investor dissatisfaction to shareholder derivative lawsuits. I think it's going to be one of those things that companies are going to have to pay a lot of attention to, even as they try to figure out what exactly it is they're supposed to do. Well, Laura and Judy, thank you both again for taking the time to talk to us. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA. I hope we're able to expand your compliance perspective.